follow the logic of his argument and call it Podium 2, with which whoever commissioned the temple, and since there are zero contemporary records we don't know who that was, wished to surround his megalomaniac masterpiece. The upshot of Lohmann's investigation is that within the U-shaped wall of Podium 2 are the remains of what he sees as an earlier building phase, which he refers to as Podium 1. His investigations show the dimensions of Podium 1 to be 12 meters in height by 48 meters north to south by 95 meters east to west, but he admits the only certain clue to its age is that it predates the Julio-Claudian Temple, in other words, the Temple of Jupiter, which was built in the main by the Julio-Claudian dynasty spanning the reigns of the emperors Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, and Nero, 27 BC to AD 68. To cut a long story short, Lohmann argues that Podium 1 was the work of Herod the Great, the Roman client king who ruled Judea in the last decades of the 1st century BC. But there are no inscriptions or other documentary evidence that could settle the matter. So the only source of information is the well-preserved structure itself, notably, according to Lohmann, its stylistic features, such as the use of alternating rows of headers and stretchers, drafted margin masonry, and the reconstruction of the plan of this early structure. These elements reveal surprisingly close parallels to Herodian sanctuaries, and in particular the temple at Jerusalem, not only in general appearance, but in their precise proportions and measurements. These correspondences, Lohmann argues, between the two building projects strongly suggest Herodian involvement, even though its precise nature remains to be determined. As we've seen, the Jerusalem temple was destroyed by the Romans in AD 70, so Lohmann is obliged to base his argument on the only surviving part of the temple, the gigantic trapezoidal platform of the Haram es-Sharif. Nonetheless, the detailed comparisons he offers do indeed make an excellent case for Herodian involvement in Baalbek's Podium 1. What remains to be settled, however, is how extensive this involvement was. To be specific, although Lohmann concedes that Tel Baalbek was continuously inhabited since the pre-pottery Neolithic period, in other words, since the time of Göbekli Tepe, and although his whole argument is that the Julio-Claudian emperors worked around Podium 1 at Baalbek when they started to build the massive and imposing U-shaped wall for Podium 2, he doesn't consider the possibility that there might have been a Podium 0, which Herod in turn overbuilt. I can hardly blame him for that, since no mainstream archaeologist that I'm aware of is willing to consider the same possibility for Herod's restoration of the Jerusalem temple, particularly with reference to the huge megalithic blocks discussed earlier that now stand exposed by the Hasmonean Tunnel. Nevertheless, it's a possibility that shouldn't be ignored at Baalbek, especially in the light of what Lohmann himself describes as the great antiquity of the site. And there's another possibility as well, which I intend to consider. It concerns the megalithic U-shaped wall that forms the base and boundary of the feature Lohmann calls Podium 2. Suppose that U-shaped wall isn't Roman at all. Suppose it was already in place before, not after, Herod built Podium 1. Suppose further that the tell that antedates Podium 1 by thousands of years was itself situated where it is because of the prior existence of the U-shaped megalithic wall. In other words, suppose the U-shaped wall, with its immense megaliths, was the very first work of architecture to be built on this site, perhaps enshrining some central feature, some primeval mound, in front of which the tell later evolved over thousands of years, until the Herodian temple was built on top of it, and then a little later overbuilt by the Temple of Jupiter. Trilithon. Having climbed a stairway set against the side of a monstrously large block, the scale of everything here is truly epic, I make my way along the top of the row of 13-foot-high, 400-ton megaliths that form the southern elevation of the U-shaped megalithic wall that Lohmann sees as part of the never-completed Podium 2. I'm heading west now, and I pass under the six standing columns, which seem less to loom than to take flight over me. So light and graceful do they appear, despite their massive size. The wall they're perched on rises to about twice my height. Its upper edge, where the columns stand, marks the level of the floor of the Temple of Jupiter where I'd sat earlier. The space between the wall and the edge of the 10-foot-wide megaliths I'm walking on is an obstacle course of broken fragments of columns and ornate multi-ton chunks of the pediment they once supported. At the end of the long row of megaliths, I'm confronted by a warren of towers, archways, and tumble-down medieval Arab fortifications. I thread my way through these. It's all a bit bewildering. Climb a flight of stairs, and take a right turn into a narrow alley at the western edge of the whole complex. I'm heading north now, and the alley, which isn't wide enough for two people to pass abreast, runs between the outer fortification wall on my left, part Roman, part Arab reconstruction, and a row of rough-hewn megalithic blocks on my right. I don't know what to make of these blocks, but a few months later, in correspondence we eventually engage in, Lohmann will tell me that they're part of a filling layer that was intended to fill up space between the Herodian wall and the later megaliths which make up the exterior shell of the second Julio-Claudian podium. They were intended to be invisible behind the shell, so they remained undressed and with a rough surface. Whatever they are, these massive blocks are separated by little more than the width of my shoulders from the hybrid Roman wall extended by Arab fortifications to my left. The feeling is one of constriction, almost claustrophobia. After 20 paces or so, however, the alley widens as the outer fortification wall, previously several courses thick, suddenly reduces to a single course which, just ahead, has a large gap in it through which I peer down onto a grassy border some 35 or 40 feet below, edged by the modern fence that surrounds the whole of the Baalbek complex. That's when I realize, for sure, I'd been half expecting it, but I wasn't certain until this moment, that I'm standing on what I've come to Baalbek to see. It's just over 64 feet long, more than 14 feet high, nearly 12 feet wide, and weighs more than 800 tons. It's the southernmost of the three famed megaliths of the Trilithon. Chapter 13. And then came the deluge. I'd hoped, I'd expected, I was almost sure that the course I'd charted through the ruins would lead me to the Trilithon. But still I feel a minor sense of triumph that my wanderings in the labyrinth have actually brought me to this very special place. It's a good moment to take stock. That single course of outer fortification masonry to my west barely covers a quarter of the Trilithon's immense width. There's part of the drum of a fallen column lying just by the gap in the fortifications that overlooks the grassy border within the perimeter fence surrounding the ruins. Pressed against the fortification wall, this column covers approximately half the width of the huge megalith it rests on, the southernmost of the three in the Trilithon. All in all, this is a sheltered spot, a quiet space, a little courtyard almost. Conveniently, there's a loose block about the height of a stool for me to perch on, and what's more, since it's afternoon now, there's a patch of shade. With a sigh of relief, I sit down, haul out my notebook, and compose my thoughts. I'm aware, as I do so, that my feet are placed not only on the Trilithon block, but also on something inscribed into it that effectively proves it is older than the Temple of Jupiter, though not how much older. The shade is working against me. The 50 years since it was first brought to light have not been kind to it, and honestly, I can't see it. However, Professor Hartoun Kalayan, the engineer placed in charge of the restorations of Baalbek by the Lebanese Department of Antiquities, explains that back in the mid-1960s, in view of the scientific interest, Emir Maurice Chehab, Director General of the Antiquity Department, decided to have the top of the Trilithon cleared. When this was done, Kalyan explains, the south block exposed a full-scale orthographic drawing of the pediment of the Temple of Jupiter. the drawing, partly extends under Roman construction, and partly it is hidden under an early period Arabic construction. This discovery suggests that the trilithon was already in place to serve as a trestle board for the dimensioning and ordering of the pediment blocks. That is, in the beginning of the second half of the 1st century AD. Further, it can be concluded that after the construction of the pediment, after the drawing had served its purpose, the constructional scheme above the level of the trilithon was executed. This is why part of the drawings extend under the Roman constructions. So right here at my feet, unfortunately invisible now without special lighting, is a convincing piece of evidence that a real mystery, not just one made up by alternative historians, surrounds the trilithon. Obviously, since it was used for an architectural drawing of part of the Temple of Jupiter, as Cullian admits, and particularly so since it was afterwards partially covered by Roman construction, the only logical deduction is that it must be older than the temple. We'll look further into the implications of this, but it should be noted right at the outset that Daniel Lohmann doesn't agree. Presenting a paper for the proceedings of the Third International Congress on Constructional History, held in the German city of Cottbus in May 2009, he argued, "Cullian suggested that this drawing proves the trilithon to be older and already in place when the temple was built. Today, new indications show that this assumption is outdated and that the trilithon and temple were built synchronous. The upper surface of this block, the southernmost trilithon block with the drawing on it, was practically used for a simultaneous construction, later simply to be covered by the next stone course." And in a follow-up paper in 2010, Lohmann expanded on his reasoning. The unfinished pre-Roman sanctuary construction, Podium 1, was incorporated into a master plan of monumentalization. Apparently challenged by the already huge pre-Roman construction, the early imperial Jupiter sanctuary shows both an architectural megalomaniac design and construction technique in the first half of the 1st century AD. The most famous example may be the trilithon, forming the middle layer of the Western Temple podium. The podium can be considered as an attempt to hide the older, inconveniently shaped temple terrace behind a podium in fashionable Roman manner. I understand Lohmann's logic, but I have a number of problems with it. First and foremost, there is the very concept of a podium that is being bandied around here. The dictionary defines podium as the masonry supporting a classical temple, or, alternatively, a stereobate for a classical temple, especially one with perpendicular sides. A stereobate, in turn, is defined as the foundation or base upon which a building or the like is erected, or alternatively, the solid foundation forming the floor and substructure of a classical temple, crepidoma, podium. A crepidoma, likewise, is the platform on which the superstructure of the building is erected. What all these definitions hold in common is the notion that a podium is a structure on top of which a temple is built. But this is not the case with Lohmann's Podium 2. It is not the foundation or base upon which the Temple of Jupiter is erected. It is not the solid foundation forming the floor of the Temple of Jupiter. And it is not the masonry supporting the Temple of Jupiter. What the Temple of Jupiter in fact stands on and is supported by, as Lohmann himself makes clear, is the Herodian Podium 1. Lohmann's Podium 2, it turns out, does not support any part of the Temple of Jupiter. It surrounds Podium 1 on three sides, but it does not support it. It is, in other words, as I described it several times in Chapter 12, a U-shaped megalithic wall, but it is not a podium. If the Romans built it as Lohmann believes, then they did not build it to serve any structural, load-bearing, podium-like purposes, but purely for cosmetic reasons, as an attempt, to repeat his own words, to hide the older, inconveniently shaped temple terrace behind a podium in fashionable Roman manner. In response, I can only repeat that podium continues to be a misleading term, which does not describe what we actually see on the ground. If Lohmann's analysis of the pre-existing Herodian works is right, then we don't see evidence of the Romans hiding the older, inconveniently shaped temple terrace behind a fashionable Roman podium. Whatever plans they may have had for extension and development, which we cannot know, and which there are no records of whatsoever, the evidence on the ground is limited to that massive, U-shaped enclosure wall surrounding Podium 1 on three sides, but not supporting it. A profoundly megalithic wall, larger in every dimension than any other that the Romans are known to have built anywhere in the world. A wall that doesn't even look Roman, incorporating blocks weighing more than 800 tons, the trilithon, that would have required truly spectacular efforts to move and put into place. I'm not saying that the Romans weren't equal to such efforts, or that 800-ton blocks were beyond the limits of their building technology. I don't know, and don't claim to know, the limits of their technology. What I'm saying is that it is quite unlike the practical, phlegmatic cast of mind of the Romans, which Lohmann recognizes, to go to such extreme lengths for purely cosmetic purposes. Surely, therefore, there is room to consider an alternative possibility, namely that the megalithic U-shaped wall was already in place long before, perhaps even thousands of years before, Podium 1 was built. But in the very paper in which Kallian asserts that the trilithon predates the Temple of Jupiter, he goes on to give another crucial piece of information that seems to pour cold water on speculation of this sort. Yes, the trilithon is older than the superstructure of the Temple of Jupiter, but not much older, because a part of a drum of a column similar in dimensions to the columns of the Temple of Jupiter is used as a block in the foundation under the trilithon. In the absence, to our knowledge, of a second monument with similar dimensions of columns in Baalbek, one can conclude that the drum was a discarded one and that the columns were already cut or were in process of shaping when the foundations of the trilithon had started. Is this the ugly little fact that destroys a beautiful theory? Is my quest for a lost civilization at Baalbek fatally compromised by Kallian's column drum? Might I just as well pack up and go home? You would think so from the skeptical literature on this subject, which endlessly regurgitates the paragraph quoted above as though it settles the matter once and for all, as though it proves beyond reasonable doubt that the trilithon is the work of the Romans, as though any further thought and questioning on the matter is spurious, pseudoscientific hogwash. Skeptical author and self-styled debunker of fringe science and revisionist history, Jason Colavito, for example, claims that archaeology and engineering can explain all the individual aspects of the trilithon, and that there is therefore no need for an alternative perspective. Rather than do the work to back up this assertion himself, however, he refers us to the wonderful writings of another self-styled skeptic, physicist Aaron Adair. Adair, in turn, simply rehashes Kallian's arguments, placing heavy reliance on the column drum in the foundations and on the architectural drawing on top of the southernmost trilithon block, to conclude, "We can be reasonably certain that the trilithon stones were put into place contemporaneously with the construction of the Temple of Jupiter. So already, by having the trilithon stones contemporaneous with the temple, we have established the Roman provenance of the structure." It all sounds reasonable, wholesome, and convincing. But actually, like so much else in the skeptical literature that is passed off as fact, it turns out, on close scrutiny, to be speculation, opinion, and bias masquerading as objectivity. That column drum that Kallian mentioned in passing, and that so many others have relied upon absolutely to reinforce established ideas about the chronology of the site, is much, much less than it seems. Ironically, the central problem that I'm coming to here is illustrated by Adair himself in a black and white photograph of the western wall of the sanctuary, apparently taken from a very old postcard, that he reproduces with his article to support his argument. Namely that there are blocks below the trilithon, and that below these blocks, out of sight in the photo, is Kallian's column drum. But what the photograph shows in the wall above the trilithon is a section of a different Roman column drum that was redeployed.